It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 63, Keeper of the Flame. We're talking about a movie from 1942, directed by George Cukor, released by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, starring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, one of the few dramatic outings for that pair. This is actually their second appearance together. And I have two great panelists to join me to discuss this movie, including a first-timer here on Lions, Towers, and Shields. It's Brandon Rottinghouse, who is a professor of political science at the University of Houston. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
It's great to have you. And also making a return appearance, because I can't talk about a Katharine Hepburn movie unless she's with me. It just feels wrong, is Judy Samuelson, who is the person I know who not only knows the most about Katharine Hepburn, but has the most stuff that is associated with her. Hi, Judy. Welcome back.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks for having me.
Well, Keeper of the Flame, I wanted to talk about this movie for a couple of reasons. It's an interesting and a little lesser known Tracy and Hepburn movie, but it is also something of a political thriller. And because it has some resonance to things that we might even be worried about today, I thought it would be interesting to talk about it. It was released in 1943. It was made in 1942, so right at the beginning of World War II. And it is essentially a story of thrills and intrigue. And then there is a political theme that becomes more apparent toward the end of the movie. In fact, if you watch the trailer for the movie, you might not even really understand that it was a political movie. And as it happened, the people who were in charge of it, Louis B. Mayer at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, didn't really like the way it came out as a political movie for precisely that reason. Because even though we're just starting in World War II, we still have tensions between the forces who are all about fighting the fascists over in Europe, and the forces who may be a little more sympathetic to some of the more conservative elements in U.S. politics, and that's the studio side of it. But I always ask the same question when I start these shows, so let me get to that and stop monologuing for a minute and ask each of you guys what your background with this movie is. Have you seen it before? Brandon, let's start with you. Do you know this movie?
I don't know the movie. I'm a big fan of the genre. I love a thriller. I also love the kind of politics that's interwoven in, especially during this era, like kind of World War II, you know, as it begins. And so not familiar with the specific movie, but definitely a fan of these characters and so many of the great character actors in the film, too. I'm really a big fan of.
Yeah, those are going to be fun to talk about. Mm-hmm. I have notes about all of the sort of small and medium sized parts, or most of them. And Judy, I'm guessing you've seen this a few times before.
A few times, yeah. That'll be an understatement. Yeah, I guess it's not the go to Tracy Hepburn movie because of its topic. And I don't think it did very well when it first opened. But I think when you watch it now, it's really quite a good movie, and it has, I think, one of Spencer Tracy's like best performances. You know, he's always talked about as being this very natural actor, but I think in this one, he's so much this character, and he portrays so much integrity and world weariness, because he's been a war correspondent, or I don't know if that's the right term for what he is, for overseas. And he's come back, he's seen a lot of the awfulness that's been going on there. So, and it's just so ingrained in his performance. I think it's a really terrific performance from him.
Yeah, he's been in Germany before he has come back to the United States to do this. He's a reporter, and he's come back to report on this person who's just died, Robert Forrest, who we never see. We only see a portrait of him on the wall from a distance. We never hear his voice. So it's one of those movies where it's interesting, because there's a movie Tracy does several years later in his career where that's the case, too, where they talk about this character for the whole movie, but you never see him because Robert Forrest, yeah. Edward, my son.
Yeah,
and in this movie, Forrest has died. As the movie begins, the first thing we see is the car going off the bridge, and we find out that Robert Forrest is this American hero who was in charge of this group called America Forward, which, of course, made me think of Lindbergh's America First, and a little eerie there. I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, and I had forgotten how good Tracy is in it. I mean, I'm a big Tracy fan, and I have a bias toward almost any performance he gives, but he really is quite exceptional in it.
Yeah.
And Hepburn's good too, but I feel like it's really Tracy's movie.
It's almost a very like sort of unusual star performance by him. She's another question, but by him, you know, it's so grown up and adult, you know, I don't know how else to put it. It's not like, there's a lot of realism to it, to his performance. Kat Hepburn, rather, there's a lot going on behind the scenes there that perhaps, you know, is the reason that her performance comes across as a little wooden or you know, stoic, or because the script was being changed constantly by the writers, but also by her sort of interference and wanting to get things done differently in the script. But I really think, yeah, I agree. It's Tracy's movie.
To me, she seems really detached. And there's sort of an ethereal quality to the character, because we're sort of trying to figure out the character from the beginning of the movie. And it kind of takes a while, because a lot of the sort of thing that propels the movie along is that you don't know what all of the various characters' motivations are, right, starting with her and going down to all, you know, most of the sort of minor characters in there have some sort of red herring role to play. And even she, it's like, what is her deal? Why is she so... I mean, you understand that she's the wife of this man, Robert Forrest, who has died, and she is ostensibly mourning him. And Tracy's reporter character wants to interview her so that he can do a very sympathetic biography of Forrest. And she is resistant, but you don't know whether that resistance is just because she's grieving or because there's something. And then very quickly we learn, because she's talking with Richard Worf, who's playing her... is playing Forrest's former secretary, that, yeah, they are, in fact, trying actively to keep stuff away from Tracy's character. And so for a while, you're not sure whether her performance is odd because of that element of the script or because it's just not, she's just not doing her best work.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Tracy character, he does come back, as you say, to do this sort of sympathetic profile on a man he admires, because what he's seen is the public face of this man, and he's come to sort of dig deeper into him. But the reason I love his performance is, like, you can tell every time he talks to, I forget the actor's name, Knox, Forrest's right-hand man that you just mentioned before.
Oh, Richard Worf.
Richard Worf, sorry.
Who ends up having a big career as a TV director after all this. Right. He's not doing a lot of actors. I actually think he's really interesting in this part. Right. But anyways, go ahead.
But Tracy, I think, is very skeptical. He's a reporter who's very skeptical about everything, the sort of rah-rah attitude that he's being faced with by these people. And slowly, that's a mystery of it. He slowly begins to unravel, you know, what's going on. And I don't know what, I don't want to give anything away, but maybe you will, Philip.
But we'll get there.
But apparently the script, what I know about the backstory of the writing of it was that, you know how that, you know, I don't know if your listeners know about the Ingmar Bergman story about Casablanca, where they never really had an ending. They had two endings. First, she's going to go off with Bogart. She's going to stay with Bogart. So she didn't know how to play it. Well, in this movie also, Hepburn is for like about a third of the movie, she believes one thing about her character. I won't say what it is. And then the script changes again, and she's got to act as though she's another, you know, the story's taking another turn. And so what she believed before, she doesn't believe now. So it's, you know, might account for some of her sort of being all over the place with it, or just being very sort of walking through it almost.
Yeah, it was a novel before it was a movie, and MGM, RKO bought it, interestingly enough, which was Hepburn's former studio, and then sold it to MGM, and MGM was going to make it with Tracy, and then she was attached to it later, as I understand. You can correct any of that, because I've done a fair bit of reading, but I haven't cross-referenced, so if I make any mistakes, Judy, you'll fix
it. No, that's right. It was for him, and then she was signed on to it. Obviously, they wanted a sophomore the hit for the two of them. They just did One of the Year, and this, even though One of the Year had sort of political, you know, issues involved, but not to the extent that this was like a total, people weren't expecting this from them.
Yeah, and of course, Woman of the Year is a comedy. And Cukor, as we've said on the show, because we've talked about Philadelphia Story and Holiday, was Hepburn's favorite director and she one of his favorite actors. And so it's an unusual movie for Cukor to do. It's an unusual movie for them to do together. And it's interesting that given that combination, excluding all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, you would have expected that he would have pulled an interesting performance. Well, she's not bad. Let me not say that, but pulled perhaps a better performance out of her.
Also, Jelly, she's a character with a lot of, not at the beginning, she's very like closed mouth, but then she has a lot of exposition. You know, she has a lot of this happened and this happened and this happened and at the climax. And that's like hard to play, I think, you know, because it's not organic to the behavior. It's just, you know, now I'm going to tell you the real story. And she just, so it's like, you know, like reading it from a book. You know?
No, yeah, I liked. I totally defer on matters of the character and timing. But I was intrigued by the kind of conflict that she faces that is about telling the truth versus keeping the flame alive. And so for me, I know that like the ways that we want to encourage people, as I think especially with my students, to engage in the political process is important and needed to be able to kind of keep this alive. And the kind of ways that we reify these institutions and these performances, you know, are necessary for us to kind of continue democracy. But there's also a need to be realistic. And so part of the kind of conflict that I was intrigued by in her character was this sort of, I want to tell the truth, but I also know that the truth will completely upend our entire way of thinking. And there's only so many times that that can happen before people are just, you know, distrustful of institutions. And so without being too much of a kind of political scientist on this, I like that they played that duality and made it a challenge for the characters to think about exactly what should we say and how much of it should we say.
Well, I think part of the behind the scenes part too was that there was a disagreement about how much of a love story there should be, because she and Tracy don't have a romance. It's clear that they care about each other, especially toward the end of the movie. And then they have chemistry because they've begun this relationship in real life.
Yeah.
And they've just made their first movie together, which is probably the most romantic of all the movies that they did. And but there was a disagreement over, you know, should the love story be at the center of it, or do we want to make it more about the politics? And the politics, I had forgotten how late in the movie the politics actually comes, which is probably why we're all kind of concerned about, like, do we want to like dive into deep spoiler territory? And again, I'm happy to spoil a movie that's 80 years old. I just figure it's kind of toward the end. And I actually took a look at when they actually start talking, when the reveal begins to happen. It's like 12 minutes before the end of the movie, because most of the rest of the movie, you're still, well, I guess you figured her out a little earlier than that, but very early in the movie, again, you're trying to figure out, I mean, my question watching the movie in the beginning, and I knew how it ended, but it had been a long time since I'd seen it. My question was, how much does she know and when did she know it? Mm-hmm. And that ends up being important, because she's married this man who's an American hero, who had been a hero of World War I, and then who got quite a lot of people sort of hanging on every word he spoke and listening to speeches and you know, becoming sort of part of a, they don't use the word army until later, but becoming an army of supporters of his, potentially a political candidate, but not somebody who was in office. He was a wealthy industrialist, I guess. They don't really say how he made his money. But she's married him, and she is one of the people that hero worshipped him. And then over time, she discovers that he is not the hero that he purports to be. And toward the very end, the sort of thing that causes the cataclysm that we'll get to is that she finds out the extent to which he is not what he seems. And she tells us how he changed, which is an interesting commentary on how certain political ideologies can kind of take over what might have been good intentions in the beginning.
And some of that last scene, I mean, maybe it's a little extreme, but maybe not for that time when sort of this fascism was sort of under the rug in America, but it was certainly there. But you could read that today, and some of it would be, you know, pitting groups against each other and you know, distrust and. But I think what you said was very important about the notion of do you maintain the the lie or the that gave people hope and that gave people, or do you tell the truth about this man and destroy their belief in the system? And you know, it's an interesting ongoing question.
Yeah. And there's a scene at the beginning with a bunch of the Boy Scouts are lined up and the coffin passes by with the, and they all kind of turn their heads sort of in this mock salute. And he's standing in line and does the same. And it occurs to me that this is what we all want. We all want to believe something. We all want to be part of it. But the truth sometimes is so dangerous that maybe it's just too much for people to handle. So that, I think, but also with Jeb, the son, that interplay with he and O'Malley is really interesting to see, like, what, how much should we say and how do we frame this? There's the point where, you know, Jeb is trying to let him into the grounds and he makes him swear an oath. Jeb makes him, O'Malley, swear this oath to say that he's going to be, you know, kind of honest and forthright, all the sort of, you know, sort of modified scout things. And that I thought was really an intriguing way to kind of approach this really delicate topic. you know, the Jeb asks him after the story about the sort of rise of fascism, who won? And O'Malley says, it's not over yet. And maybe that's the theme that, you know, we're living through today. It's not over yet. It'll always be there. And there's something that's, you know, under the surface, just constantly looming. I'm reminded a little bit of one of my other favorite movies, and that's Saboteur. Was this kind of network of these spies who are doing these, you know, horrible, you know, kind of events that are, you know, sabotaging kind of the war effort. And you'd think this would never happen, but I don't, you know that anymore. It feels like things are happening like that. The kind of sabotage is all around us and trying to maneuver it is a challenge. One of the things, last thing I'll say is on that is that it struck me that the mechanism for how it's described and the way that it works is so compelling. One of the things O'Malley says is, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, but he says something like that they try to get us all confused and scared and sore at each other. And before you know it, clamp, the handcuffs are on us. And I like that because that's what's happening. We're in a moment where we don't trust each other and it's creating these lack of trust in each other and institutions, and people no longer care about these things that are so important to the remaining the pillars of democratic rule.
And the fascinating thing about that again is that's all in the last 12 minutes or so of the movie. Mm-hmm. And so part of me thinking about what we live through today is wanting to have had more of it, because at the point where, as we said, O'Malley is writing a sympathetic documentary, a sympathetic biography of Forrest. That's what he wants to do. And even at the point that Jeb is letting him into the grounds and he's swearing that oath, there's nothing insidious on the surface about that. I don't even think in the O'Malley character. In fact, the most cynical people at the beginning of the movie are probably his fellow reporters who are stuck back at the hotel.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get access. And so they're just thinking about it in those terms. And O'Malley is sort of wide-eyed and kind of open. And he's like, this guy is heroic and I want to talk about him. And it's only, even in the middle of the movie, when we're sort of trying to figure out the cause of his death, there's a way in which it could just be the people around him. We don't know that he's somebody to be feared or loathed until the very end. And which the fascinating thing about that to me is that there was so much, you know, people like Luby Mayer, who was quite white right wing. He didn't like this movie, didn't like the way it had turned out. It was written by Donald Ogden Stewart, who was famously quite left wing and got in trouble with the blacklists a little bit later. But most of this movie is sort of pure like thriller and even accepts the hero worship. And then we say at the end of the movie, yeah, but it's not all that it seems.
There's also, I think, a kind of element of trust in the media to their jobs. Well, I thought that was interesting. I love how these movies portray journalists, these sort of, you know, sort of grizzled, you know, I love that. So I'm a sucker for that every time, but I like that they talk about this in a way that is hard to see today, where people trust the media to kind of set this agenda. And at the end, you say kind of the big reveal and his sort of story about her, the wife, and this kind of the way things have come about. This is just a stunning contrast to where things are now. We're trusting the media so low, and this affective polarization we have where we just hate each other because you're on the other team means that most people wouldn't believe you even if you told them the truth. And so I like that kind of dynamic to it too, as we watch it play out then and we watch it play out now.
That seems not to be the case back then in this movie, because ultimately he writes her story.
Yes.
And that's really where the movie ends, you know, but you get this sense that, okay, now he's going to be revealing the truth to people. And now she's going to be the real sort of savior of, you know, I don't know that you could do that today. I think there's too much division, and you know, it wouldn't turn people around necessarily. But then it was sort of very like the patriotic thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end, you know, she's telling him, you know, write the story, you know what I mean? Don't hold back. And right, she says the following line, "I trust you." And I thought, wow, that's so stunning to see this happen in this era. And it's just such a motivating force, but now it's so hard to see people rally around this truth because truth is so politicized, just like everything else.
Funny too is that at the end when we find out sort of the way that the plan is supposed to work is that we're going to turn people against one another, groups against groups, and presumably, although it's not really expressed explicitly, we're going to, you know, sow mistrust of the media. We're going to plant articles that say this group is bad, or that, you know, I hate this group and I hate that group, and so there is. In the planning of this sort of fascist takeover of the United States that's anticipated, there is that sort of let's sow distrust. But the bottom line that we are allowed to get out of the movie with is when O'Malley tells his story, it's expected that it will be believed and accepted and that people's reactions will be, oh, wow, we dodged a bullet. This right. cabal is now at an end.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it goes back to, like, because we're at the start of World War II, you always have to put that lens on it. Again, it's the thing was written, I think, in 41, so it ostensibly could have happened before World War II, although I bet it wouldn't have been made. I honestly think if World War II hadn't started, because I think the MGM bought it right at the end of 41, so it would have been after Pearl Harbor, and then they make it the next year, because there was enough... either pro-fascist or fascist accepting stuff in the United going on politically in the United States, that movie studios, particularly who were run by fairly right-wing people, would have been less likely to take it on. In fact, there are famously very few pre-World War II movies that even address Nazism because there were those studios had markets in Germany that they were protecting, among other things. And so it's interesting because once you put the lens of World War II on, the question of well, do we tell the truth about this guy or do we simply bury it? It's not so much a matter of, you know, whether they are going to succeed or not, but it's whether are we going to bury this so that people's illusions about this man will not be destroyed. And the right decision from the movie's point of view is made that we know it's better to tell him. But I maintain that that's a case that's easier to make in the world of 1942 because we're at war at this time with... people in the fascist camp.
Yeah. There's an absolutism that it doesn't seem like it fits in today's world, political world. I think people are kind of relative to party is the concern, so that there's not a kind of universalistic, this is good, this is bad. And there's a sort of reference to democracy. It's about sort of your own predilections and party. And that obviously changes the dynamics of what is important and what's not and what's truth and what's not.
Well, let's talk about some of the movie making, and then I think we can come back to the last scene where we sort of, as I say, have the reveal, and then we have the resolution that allows us to get out of the movie. But before we get there, we have a lot of stuff going on where the characters we meet include the right-hand man of Robert Forrest, who's played by Richard Worf, again, who goes on to become a quite prolific television director. And then we have the caretaker, who's played by Howard Da Silva, often cast as a villain in later films. Not in this one, but we don't know that early on. And his son, Jeb, played by Daryl Hickman. And then we have the cluster of reporters back at the hotel who are saying witty things to Spencer Tracy every time he comes down from the house. And if I heard Joshua in the Walls of Jericho one more time, I was going to scream. It kind of got on my nerves, to be honest.
Audrey Christie, yeah.
Yeah, not her fault. She didn't write those lines.
No.
And I kept thinking that could either have... Yeah, she's very good.
She's so good.
I found the character kind of annoying. I found it annoying, but she did a great job. I did keep thinking that could also have been Ruth Hussey or Eve Arden. I was thinking of Ruth Hussey in the Philadelphia story.
Right.
Like, yeah, she totally could have done that part.
But she's also, you know, he's in the beginning, at least she knows what he's been through in Europe and sees how he wants to, you know, promote this idea of, you know, fighting fascism, and he wants to do it with this article about Forrest. But she also, she like brings him down to earth a little bit about, I mean, even about the simplest things, even about, you know, about his ego and about his, you know, how she's thinking more in grays and he's thinking at this point more in, you know, black and white and good hat, bad hat. So I like her character, but, you know, that's true.
It's true. She's more of the cynical reporter than he is.
Yeah.
By a lot. And she's also got a big crush on him. So that doesn't help either.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah. And then we have the cousin character who is probably the biggest red herring in the movie, who is played by Forrest Tucker, who is, turns out he's Christine, the Hepburn character's cousin. But we don't know early on, is he a love interest of hers? Who is he actually related to? What is that guy's deal? Yeah. And so it does feel like all those characters in combination and what they're doing in the movie provide enough distraction, because if you think about it, the actual story of the movie, you kind of need some time to lay it out. And so we might as well throw the question of whether the cousin is a bad guy or whether the secretary is a bad guy, spoiler alert, he is, whether Howard Da Silva's character is a bad guy, who's a super intriguing character. The caretaker was in the war with Robert Forrest. He was Forrest's commanding officer, and then he gets wounded and Forrest saves his life. And then he ends up coming back and being the caretaker. And he is the kind of guy that when we learn that Robert Forrest is in fact not the hero that we think he is, he's the kind of guy whose resentment could potentially lead him to join such a movement, because he's been treated badly after World War I, and is in reduced circumstances. And then his kid, Jeb, is this wide-eyed devotee of Forrest. And then for the majority of the movie, there's an absent sister. What's her deal? And we find out a little bit later. So those are interesting. I find the supporting cast and the way they're deployed really interesting, because they all have their own things going on. And as I say, I think it makes it easier for the main focus of the movie to be a little less intense, because we have to stop and see Janet come back from the sanatorium, or we have to see Christine go away for 3 days so that she can be with her or whatever. And so I like those aspects of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I did too. I liked, and in particular, also the cab driver. I thought had a really great kind of position.
Percy Kilbride.
Yeah. Good. His accent's brilliant in this. I love the way that he has these lines, but I think he kind of has this ambiguity about what he's really doing. How much does he really know? And so he's kind of furthering the plot with these kind of cryptic statements. As at one point he talks about that, you know, good and evil are always battling each other, and at some point you have to take a side. And so we're trying to figure out, like, what does this mean? So I thought that was a really great way to just, kind of maneuver the plot along. And Tracy's really involved in that. He needs to get this from him and is not really getting the clear answers he needs.
And that actor famously was Pa Kettle in the Ma and Pa Kettle movies, where accent was very different. And I kept expecting him to go, Pepperidge Farm remembers, because he's got the whole New England accent thing going on.
But he's kind of the guy that, you know, he's what, like what we say now, you know, hate the candidate, but don't hate the people who voted for the candidate. He's that guy. He's not on either, you know, he's just folks, you know, and he believes in right and wrong and, you know, facts and non-facts. And he does it in a very short scene. I mean, he doesn't take a lot for him to realize, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. He's not taking any guff from anybody, or, you know, it's really clever.
Yeah, I like how we meet him and all the reporters out front want a cab, and he says the cab is for hire, and then he takes the sign down and Tracy comes out and he takes Tracy instead. And you sort of, they don't explain what prior arrangement they might have had, but obviously it works out for him.
Yeah. And the attention to his breaking and entering the scene.
Right.
And then we have another character who isn't quite a red herring, but you don't know what it's all about. Margaret Wycherly, who plays Robert Forrest's mother, who we didn't even know existed at the beginning of the movie. But Forrest has quite an estate there. He's got a big mansion that he lives in, and then there's a whole other house where the mother lives, and then there's the Arsenal of Ideas, which was a fort from the 1700s. So and plenty of room for riding horses and all sorts of things. In any case, so the mother character we find out is not mentally balanced, but she has moments of lucidity, but you can't tell which those are. And so there's a point in the movie where Tracy meets up with her. I think her performance is really interesting too. I read one review which posited that hers is the only good performance in the movie. I don't agree with that at all, but I think her performance is really interesting.
You know, I don't know. I haven't admittedly read the book. I have the book, but I've never read it. So I don't know. There's a few movies like that. I wonder what Forrest was. Did he become the sort of monster we're made to believe that he ultimately was, or did he start from a different place? I don't know if that's in the book. There are a number of like movies like that, that where, you know, I mean, Citizen Kane is like that, you know, he starts off as this man of the people and then gets corrupted, or, you know, All the King's Men, or, you know, where the sense of power or whatever overcomes them. And then they turn into dictators or fascists or whatever. I don't know if that's in the book or not, but I just wondered about that. Always wondered about that. If he was always from the get-go, you know.
In the movie, it's implied, but I can't tell based on what Christine says, but you can't tell, in my opinion, whether that's true or whether that's her perception, because she admits to having married him when she idealized him.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Just something.
So it's hard to tell, but it is. Well, and in fact, some of the people who had issues with this movie think it was too closely patterned after William Randolph Hearst, who, of course, was the basis for Citizen Kane, and that got Orson Welles in all sorts of trouble. And Hearst was a good friend of L.B. Mayer's. The figure I've always thought of that this guy resembled was actually more Lindbergh, because Charles Lindbergh is this hero. He's an aviator, and he, you know, crosses to Europe
American
and comes back.
Hero.
And
he's
giant hero. And then he gets notoriety in the early 30s because his child is kidnapped. So he still has all this sort of favorable opinion in the culture. Mm-hmm. And then in the mid 30s, he visits Germany and becomes very enamored with Hitler and comes back in like 1940. And there were fears that he might run for president, but he had the America First organization, and he spoke out against America being a part of entering World War II. He was a big isolationist, and it wasn't, you know, there are writings that indicate that he was very enamored of Hitler, that he did not start a movement that was explicitly fascist, but he certainly did not want to see the U.S., you know, going after Nazism and fascism in the way that it did. And so I don't know whether if it's because I had read that history. I read a biography of Anne Lindbergh fairly. I had seen the movie like right after I'd read that book. So I was like, oh, I see. That's an interesting parallel. Mm-hmm. But the things I was reading today and yesterday were sort of talking about William Randolph Hearst more so, sort of a mogul who starts off with maybe more altruistic ideas, and then he gets not only some power but some popularity. He gets acclaim, and then he, you know, goes off the deep end, so to speak.
And I think it's interesting that it happens so easily. And I think, you know, we tend to think that these things are, you know, these sort of monsters develop, but it really does happen so organically and so naturally that you don't even really need it. You don't even recognize it. So actually one of the sort of true to life political figures I thought of that occurred after this was Alan Shivers, who was governor of Texas and the most conservative Democrat the state has ever seen, maybe the most conservative person the state's ever elected governor, including our current crop. And he basically did the same thing. He kind of divides the state based upon this kind of class sensibility. He goes after unions, uses sort of communism as a wedge against people, and the kind of herring and these various tropes about kind of, you know, who's willing to work and who's not, and who's a true American, who's a true Texan. And this really divides the Democratic Party and lets him capture power. And I don't think ultimately it was like fascism was the goal, but you see that play out, that's a easy way to get power. And it happens so smoothly that until it's done, you often don't see it.
He was in the 50s, right?
Yeah, like late 40s and early 50s. Right. Yeah.
That's interesting. I'd never thought of that parallel. I mean, I know a little bit about Shivers, but not all that much.
Yeah. They did this big campaign. It was I guess you'd call it like a documentary. It was called the Port Arthur Statement. And it was about the kind of the strike that was happening in Port Arthur, which was a normal union strike, and they played it up to be this sort of big fight between communism and capitalism, and it allowed Shivers to win over fairly liberal Ralph Yarborough, and the rest is sort of history. The political, you know, kind of winds stay very conservative in the state, and ultimately the party, Democratic Party, kind of breaks up, and you see the remnants of that today. But that's definitely a way that you can get and keep power, and the recipe continues to work. And so I guess it's what's amazing, surprising is that people, people keep seeing it, and like it's not like a secret, but all of a sudden it's happening in plain sight, and we don't see it. I mean, you can make the same case for sort of the politics of today that, you know, Donald Trump is more or less doing this, and these sort of Republicans who are, you know, using these wedge issues against the rest of the country is just a way to get power. The end may not be known right now, but once you have the power, you can decide what you want. And what better way to keep that power than to have a sort of fascist state that, you know, removes the kind of democratic elements of it.
I really, Shelley, was saying, I really wonder back then what would have happened had it not been for the war. You know, growing up, my attitude, you know, my background is my parents were in concentration camps. So my background is, you know, America came in and we're, you know, the heroes, and we're fighting fascism, and we're, you know, and that everybody in America was like that.
Yeah.
And I've heard lots of stories about, you know, anti-Semitism in the military and just all over. So it's an ongoing thing. It never went away. It's and it has to be, you know, it's what, sorry, I don't mean to be throw politics into this really, but it's what, you know, Biden is saying, like, we have to fight it. We have to fight for democracy. Not just Biden is saying it, but, you know, people of good, whatever faith. It's really a fight. It's not a given.
It is.
By any means.
It never ends,
As we find out late in the movie, it's not just sort of a gradual creep toward, one man's undoing turns the country into a fascist state. There's an organized plan. And I think that's really important, because it's not just that this guy was charismatic and got carried away. And I want to talk in a minute about the decision to not show him other than a distant photograph and how that affects how we perceive him. But you find out toward the end that this group of people, so he's the figurehead and definitely in charge, but you find out that there's a group of people who's financing it. You find out that they have articles that they're going to post, post because we have the internet in 1942, that we're going to place in newspapers that are designed to pit groups against one another. It's not simply to argue for a particular political philosophy, but they're written in such a way that we have different religious groups antagonizing each other. We have labor versus capital. We have racial antagonism that is being stoked by this effort. And so it's explicit that we're not just going to accidentally fall into fascism. There are people for whom this is an actual goal.
Well, if you'd said something to people then, maybe they would have said, oh, well, that's, you know, those are conspiracy theories. That could never happen. But I'll just, QAnon, I really related to that. Maybe it wasn't as planned out with, you know, folders of, you know, who would pit against it. But I just think there's more there than people really that talk about. And then there's more planning there. Maybe not the beginning stage, but now.
That's a great point.
People on the inside who are, creating this the world we live in now.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one of the moments that stood out to me was when you had Christine Forrest's character say something like, "It's a pity how easily people can be fooled." And I think that says it all. People are fooled by the strangest of things that are untrue or half true. And it definitely has this pernicious effect on creating these perspectives that are profoundly wrong and really, you know, like troublesome to the foundation of democracy.
I think she's talking about herself too, because she was somebody who admired him, and the way the character is written, she's a very sort of elegant, aloof, person, she's not really emotional. Like, oh my God, I fell in love with this man and I was emotionally, you know, and then I found out these terrible things. You know, she's, it's a very detached sort of writing. But clearly she was disillusioned. And the interesting thing to me is that, and they, you know, she knew some, she knew something was going on before, but she doesn't really find out the extent of the actual planning of this fascist takeover until like the day before, which is what precipitates the end of his life. And before we should probably just sort of walk through that long final sequence. But before we do, I just wanted to talk a little bit about or ask you guys what you think about the decision to not show Forrest. Obviously, he had died at the beginning of the movie. We don't see him. We see his car tumble off the bridge. And then we see him in a photograph that's in a painting that is shown from a distance. And the reason it's interesting that they don't have any other representations of him is that there are these phonograph records that are his speeches. And apparently they were going to cast a voice actor to do his voice. And they didn't do it for whatever reason. But the implication is that you could have had more of Forrest himself in the movie. And I guess I'm wondering what you guys think about that choice. Was that the right thing to do? Or would you like to have seen more?
I would not like to have seen more because he was... He was an idea. You know, had he been a character in the movie, they would either have had to make him, you know, sort of comically evil or it's like the unseen. Your imagination builds it up to more than it maybe is. Or, you know, I think he would have been like an unrealistic character. He would have been, you know, like the secretary, you know, even in his speeches to, even in his comments to the news reporters where he plays the speeches, and he's very, I mean, I didn't, before I even knew the topic of the movie, I just suspected him from the beginning because he, the, just the way the that kind of character is written, it's very, I don't know the right word, but he just seemed too sort of one note, and unless they really were able to finesse it and make Forrest, you know, first of all, they could have made him more human, which also might have been worked against them because in depicting him as a real villain, I don't know, just the notion that there was this person, this overpowering person, but we don't know in what sense, good or evil, I think was a good choice.
I totally agree. I think less is more here. I also think that part of the point was that we're supposed to see this in everybody. This is something that could happen to any person. And so maybe not having it be a specific person, a living, breathing entity that we can say, that's the type of person that to whom this happens. We can say that it could be really any of us. So I think maybe that works too. Maybe the third thing is that I wonder, and this is above my pay grade with respect to like how these films are done and how to interpret them, but it would have been very similar to kind of a Citizen Kane at that point where you'd see too much of that person and sort of get to know them in different ways. So you have to really develop that character around that. And I'm not sure that's what the movie was intentionally.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes total sense. I absolutely agree with that. I like Citizen Kane. I admire the filmmaking a great deal, but I guess if I had one criticism, it would be I never really sympathize with the Orson Welles character, even in the beginning, because there's so much of him. There's so much Orson Welles going on in there. And it's like you can tell that something is going to change. And I don't, and in this movie, whether, you know, you're always going to, especially in a studio system where whoever they hired to play him or even to voice him probably would have been somebody known to the audience. If you had done that, if you'd cast him, people would, you know, lay their thoughts about that actor's past work on to that. And it would have, yeah, it would have had a lot of overtones.
It would have subverted what the story is about. Yeah.
So, as I mentioned, the sort of political content of the movie really shows up mostly at the end. It's all together in that one, the sort of last 12 minutes of the movie where we wrap this up.
You can't take a bathroom break. Yeah.
Exactly. Don't stop. You have 12 minutes left, but you have to keep going. And early in the movie, the secretary, Kerndon, has said to Christine Forrest go and burn some stuff, go and burn some papers. And she has already been in the arsenal of ideas, which is this old fort, this windowless brick built stone building from the 1700s on the property, which is his, which is Forrest's office and his library. And she's already been in there. She's burned some stuff, but now she's going to go back and presumably either burn or at least, you know, understand what else is in there. And does O'Malley finds her, and that's where she shows him the complete and thorough records of what the cabal, the plan is. There's a safe with money in it. There's all these binders with articles that are intended to sow discontent. There are names of people who were involved in the plot and who funded it and the whole thing. And she basically explains at that point, hey, I married this guy. I was, you know, enamored of his of what he stood for, and then I gradually realized he wasn't what I thought. And then the day before he died, I found this out, and I had the opportunity to warn him that the bridge was out, and I did not because I thought it would be better for him to die clean in the rain. I've got that quote a little wrong. It's a paraphrase. Than it would be to, you know, fight it out another way. And so we find out that she is in fact responsible for his having died, but she says she's done it because, you know, that's what has to happen. And so then for some, this is, there's a point before this happens, and this is the thing that floors me about this. So O'Malley comes onto the property and he comes in contact with the secretary, who we now know is a villain pretty much. He doesn't really understand. He has a pretty good idea that he's not his friend, but he doesn't really know the extent to which the secretary is involved. And he basically says to the secretary, who's in a car, he says, hey, where's Christine? And he goes, oh, she's over there in the arsenal. And then they have like fully 6 or 7 minutes to do exposition and for all this to be explained to O'Malley. And I'm like, where? Because he has to know that something bad. You would think he would have come much earlier and either set fire to the building, which is what he does, or somehow tried to stop them. But he doesn't. So we have plenty of time for this to play out, which I think is incredible.
But, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, in terms of performance that I was saying before about Hepburn, sort of the script changing on her, is I think in the beginning, she was supposed to be that she didn't cause his demise on purpose. And then a version of it was that she did. And so it was like I was saying before, it's, well, I'm innocent, well, you know, by association or whatever. But now I'm actually the one who did it. And so, you know, for an actor to play, how do you, you know, play that? And granted, it's, you know, they don't shoot in sequence or anything. So I'm sure it was very disjointed and was one of the reasons where she, that why she, her mistake, the big mistake was she, you know, she always had a reputation for, you know, butting into everything on a set. And my view always, but I'm biased, is that most of the time it was for the benefit of the project as opposed to just her part of it. I think she wanted a different, she wanted her part built up a little bit. I don't exactly know in what fashion, but she didn't go to Donald Logan Stewart, who was a friend of hers, and she didn't go to Victor Saville, who was the producer. She went over their heads to the big brass, and when, you know, it caused a serious wedge initially in her relationship with Donald Ogden Stewart, because they've known each other since their late 20s, that they eventually resolved and made up. But, you know, I don't know why I started with this, but that was one of the reasons for her sort of, you know, we didn't really know where she stood for most of it. And she probably didn't know where she stood for most of it either.
Well, that's sort of funny, given that she's just been through Woman of the Year, which had an ending change. You know, yes. It's like you completely change the way you feel about the movie based on the ending. And I don't know that it's extreme here, but it certainly affects her performance.
When she wrote this letter to Donald Ogden Stewart, an abject apology for doing what she did because she felt it ruined their friendship, one of the things she points out was that she was just coming off Woman of the Year, where they had they had a script and they had an ending, and then the studios didn't like it. So they had sent two other writers to do it. And then they didn't like that ending. So they had the other writers come back and do this ending that people always criticize, which is a slapstick, you know, ending in the kitchen. And she'd just been through that kind of thing. And she was just trying to make things better, but she did it the wrong way. She didn't go to him. She went to, you know, I don't know, mayor's office or whomever, you know, higher up than the writers, certainly, which most everybody was at the studio, higher up than the writers. She writes about that experience that she'd just been through, and that she was, it was coloring her view of Keeper of the Flame script.
So now we have Kerndon, that's his name. I always forget the character, the secretary's name. Kerndon sets fire to the building, and then he shoots Christine through the chink in the stone, and she is fatally wounded. And this is the point at which she tells Tracy to, tell the story. And then Kerndon gets killed once Tracy gets out, and Tracy doesn't kill him. But anyway, so Tracy is free to, presumably the fire got put out before anything was destroyed, although it was a stone building. So I suppose that it slowed it up quite a bit. But that leaves Christine dead, and it leaves Tracy free to tell the story. And as we discussed, the impression is left that his having told the story is going to be enough to have people believe that this terrible thing happened, and presumably as they go through being at war, to learn from it and grow from it as a society.
But that too is like movie making in its, you know, I haven't read the book, but I think it was either in the book or in one of the early scripts where she doesn't die at the end, but she reveals things and then they depart. He goes off, I don't know, the train somewhere, but it was revealed that she did this thing to her husband, or she was, you know, responsible for not having him avoid that bridge. And the green officer, whatever, said, you know, well, she's murdered someone. You have to have her die.
Oh, right.
And I don't think she didn't tend to do melodrama a lot, but this was, I don't know. Was she ever shot? She was never shot in the movie. She never held a gun in her hand in a movie, except, you know, not in the sense that, you know, Betty Davis held guns to like kill someone.
It's true. It's a very unusual scene. She's having a death scene, and she's telling Spencer, tell him goodbye, you know, basically go and make it right.
Right.
Which is really unusual for her.
Right.
We've talked a lot about how this movie has, sadly, probably more resonance today than a different kind of resonance than it would at the time. Again, I think at the time, it's so colored by the fact that we are in the war. And I always, in reading about World War II, I always try to think about like what part of the war we're in. So in 1940, this is made in 1942 and released in early 1943. We're not really winning at that point. Mm. We're still struggling. And it feels like it, you know, that because a lot, there's a whole lot of rah-rah propaganda and that's put out by the movie studios during the entire war. But during this sort of early parts of the war, I think there really is a very sort of tenuous sense about whether we're going to be successful. And I also feel like that given what was going on before the war in terms of right-wing or even fascist elements gaining ground, there has to be a lot of gear shifting in order to sort of get us all on the same page, right, so we can fight the war. And it's intriguing to look at this movie in that context.
Yeah, like some of the characters are very wary, and except the journalists who are, you know, understand the kind of rhythms of these things. But I like that Tracy's performance had that depth of unhappiness, of a kind of longing that there's, it's such a challenge, it's such a struggle, and it must be such an emotional toll on people. And I think his performance really kind of demonstrated that in a really good way.
And just in a very trivial bit, because I, as a Spencer Tracy fan, have to point this out, he's in peak slanted hat wearing. That is something Tracy did a lot. But oh my God, his slant game was really good in this movie. And I love it. It's adorable.
It is good. He's dapper, yes.
And Women of the Year, when he, he gets the, I don't know if it's when he gets, now I'm blanking out on what he gets the new hat, but when the Roscoe, what's his name? The guy who plays the other reporter. Oh my God, I'm blanking out.
I don't remember.
You know, comes in and Tracy says, oh, it's just an old snoot I had reblocked, you know? And the way he blocks his own hat is like, you can't even see his face. It's like Joan Crawford in a woman's face. It's like,
right? That's totally true. Yes.
But it was so signature him, you know? Bogart didn't wear it like that or whatever, you know?
Nope.
Her signature Tracy.
That's funny.
He loves looking out from under the brim and sort of going, I'm pretty cute, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's, and in this, the fact that he did it 100% of the time in this movie just cracks me up because it's like drama. And I don't know. Anyway, he's like, I'm still going to be Spencer Tracy. Got a little rom-com action going on here.
Anyways. So can I add something about Tracy and Hepburn? I want to read from this. This is from the letter that she wrote apologizing to Donald Ogden Stewart, and she explains all her reasoning. And she says, if you think I was wrong, then I must have been wrong. You know, she realizes that she was about going over his head and, you know, not discussing things with him and being involved in everything. And she said, you know, I thought at first that I should just sort of, you know, shut up and be an actor and not be involved. But I am who I am. And that's what I did. And at the very end of the letter, she says, I'm supremely sorry for this. I was guilty as far as you were concerned of the great crime of that lot, lack of enthusiasm and excitement. May I add to this, this is romantic in me, was reading this to you. May I add to this that for the first time in my life, I am humbly, sweetly, desperately in love, was then, and frantically trying to understand this feeling and to become a woman rather than the working automaton, which I have been for years. Don, try to understand and forgive me. It will be awful to think that I've caused someone I am fond of such misery and that they won't have anything to do with me. I like you and I like Ella, who's his wife, and we have a lot in common, and it can't just be put in the trash heap. So.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, my contribution.
Love it. Love it. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for joining me for this conversation about Keeper of the Flame. It was a lot of fun, and I love when people who know lots of things about lots of things come on the show, because otherwise it's just us pontificating about whether we like the way people wear their hats. That's my yes. So thank you, Judy Samuelson and Brandon Rottinghouse, for joining me. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a discussion of a very different movie, Judy Garland's The Clock.
I love that movie.
It's a great movie. And if you want to participate in this show, you can go to theincomparable.com/LTS, where you can subscribe and read show notes for this and every episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. And if you want, you can write us at LTS@theincomparable.com. See you in a couple weeks. Bye now.